today, if two people were having a conversation about educational equity, they'd most likely be discussing funding differences, because money is oftentimes cited as the clearest indicator of educational equity between districts. However, anyone in this room knows that educational equity is much more than an economic discussion. So for the next few minutes, we're going to take a very broad view of educational equity, touching upon contributing factors including poverty and wealth, race, family conditions, language barriers, gender differences, access to technology, teacher quality, schools in receivership, community schools, school choice, and maybe even the presidential election. In other words, this discussion is going to get a little complicated. To help us gain perspective, we've invited a group of very thoughtful people who think about educational equity issues a lot. Each one brings a very unique point of view, and I've been promised that there are no wallflowers here at the table, and they're ready to go. So allow me to introduce to you our panelists. We have Dr. Betty Rosa, who is the Chancellor of the New York State Board of Regents. Welcome. And no, we didn't set these up as it's a pro-con sort of thing. I don't want you to think that, all right? This is a bit random. We also have Dr. Barbara Nevergold, who's the president of the Buffalo City Board of Education. Sitting next to Barbara is Carl Christoph, who's a partner with Hodgson Russ, a law firm here in Buffalo. He does a lot of school work. Back over here, we have Dr. Michael Wendt, who is a superintendent of Wilson Central School District, located in Niagara County, just east of here. David Rust is the executive director of Say Yes to Education Buffalo. Say Yes to Education Buffalo. David? Sean Nelms is the superintendent of the Educational Partnership Organization at the University of Rochester. Sean? Yolanda McBride has joined us, and she is the Director of Public Policy at the Children's Aid Society in New York City. Thank you very much for coming, Yolanda. And last, but certainly not least, by any means, is Derek Morton, who is a senior at Buffalo Center for Art and Technology. Derek, welcome. Thank you all for being here today. It is generally understood that educational equity is achieved when students receive the resources they need to graduate to be successful after high school. Researchers tell us that educational equity is dependent upon two factors. The first is fairness. Fairness. So I'm going to ask a question of you. Show of hands. How many of you believe that factors that are beyond a student's control, things like race, poverty, family situation, homelessness, their zip code, things that are beyond their control are very likely to predict their academic outcomes? How many of you believe that? Okay?
Yep.
All right. That issue of fairness and what you just said is very important. Experts will also indicate that a second contributing factor to educational equity is inclusion. All students get this opportunity. So by a show of hands, how many of you think that your school system provides every student, high quality instruction, qualified teachers, good facilities, sustainable resources? Every student. Okay, we have some people here, but probably a minority of people here. So let's go and to the panel and find out what they think. Ladies and gentlemen, by what I just learned here, this audience seems to suggest that not all students have access to these high-quality instruction. If we're going to make a difference in all children's lives, if we're going to reach that level of educational equity, what are we going to have to do differently to get students on track to graduate, college and career ready? And I want any of you to jump in there.
Okay, I'll bite.
Go.
I think there are two things, and I'm sure there are a lot more things than that, but two things immediately occurred to me. First is a training component. And by that I mean training for all educators, and particularly with respect to the biases we all hold that the researchers tell us are certainly common to the human condition. But particularly I'm thinking about biases with respect to children, based on their race, based on their gender, based on their sexual orientation, their physical, mental ability. I think training our educators to start with, to deal with their own biases in those connections, can't do anything other than help. The other thing that I would think of, and it's a pretty common piece that I've seen as I've wandered around, and that's access to what some educators call the hands-on kinds of education, arts, music, physical education, the kind of things that teach children how to deal with one another. I think once they learn that, the skills that we otherwise teach them will be able to be applied by them in society at large. So I think those are two things, certainly. That
anybody else want to tell us what they think?
I do.
What has to happen? Okay, Derek?
Actually, I would like to agree with him on the second point. Most students learn multiple ways, and there is multiple, more than one way of learning, which is our common textbooks. And students like to, like he said, hands-on. Students like to hear music, multiple different things. And if you would like to incorporate that in your learning system, that'd be great.
Okay, and we heard that from the previous speaker about having music in the building, music in the classroom, and things of that nature. Someone on this side.
Yeah, I think the most important thing, kind of to pull in what was said earlier, is that we need to establish and continue expectations, high expectations for all kids. Carl mentioned bias and training on the biases. No matter what we do, bias will be present in the human race. But we can all have an expectation, and in terms of our school districts, and that comes from the top down. So as an administrator, and I've been an administrator for over 20 years, it's really important for me, and as our president said, she came from one side of the tracks, and the tracks don't always divide poverty and race, but we know that term, and we should have an expectation for all sides of the tracks. If we have an expectation that's high, I think the research is out there and has been plentiful and significant in terms of our kids will reach that expectation.
Barbara, what do you think?
Yeah, let me back up a little bit and say I want to thank you for bringing this group together for having this conversation. I think it's very important that we have this conversation. When I was asked to be a part of this, a reporter called me and said, what do you think you're going to accomplish from this? And I said, well, I think the dialogue is very important, because through the dialogue, we begin to identify and understand definitions of terms. And so, we throw out equity, but people also think equality, and they're not the same thing. So the dialogue helps us to define what we're talking about. I mean, I think children can have equal access, but not necessarily equity in the process. So I think the dialogue itself, it helps us to do a mind adjustment. So I think there needs to be some idea about how do we help people to adjust their thinking around some of these issues. I'm very glad that we have a student here with us today. Derek, you're very brave to stand up here with everybody and face this crowd, but we need to hear the student's voice. And I'm sorry that we are actually in conflict with a panel that's going on now in another room of students from the Buffalo School District, because they are expressing, hopefully, some of the answers to the question that you're asking. So I think that we need to also think about incorporating the voice of the children, because they're creative, because they're intelligent, because they're insightful, and they can help us to understand where we need to adjust our thinking in order to address this problem.
You think the answers lie within?
Well, I think that's part of the issue. Okay. We talk about how do we address this issue.
Chancellor?
Sure. I'm going to go to the fact that equity, as we know, we've been listening to equity and social justice as the issue of our time. And I'm going to go to, we do have some issues in terms of structural and social barriers. But more importantly, we do have an issue of the way we allocate resources and opportunities. If we can talk about expectations, we can talk about high quality, we can talk about assessment for a great period of time. But the truth of the matter is that some students require more support and to get what they need to get to be success. And so when we get into this discussion of standardization of equity, it is a problem because we know that to educate certain children takes a lot more resources. And we need to create more opportunities, and we need to also create the issue of access. And I want to remind us that our diversity, our country, has shifted from 1960 to current, from 85% as a white country to 63%. So we have had major shifts. And with these major shifts, we really have to also shift in terms of the way we respond to educating our students.
What you just said leads me to my next question, and it's the state foundation aid formula is based in part on poverty statistics from 2000, a regional cost index that hasn't been updated in years. State aid mostly ignores changes in enrollment. Poorer districts, which rely more heavily on state aid because they generally have less property wealth, spend about two-thirds of what rich districts spend. So, question, should the state aid formula be adjusted to direct more resources to districts that serve disadvantaged students? Anybody want to take that one? State aid. Changing the formula, directing more money. Mike, you want something to say about that?
Sure, there's been a lot of discussion about state aid, and we have to be careful what we wish for, because right now state aid is based on enrollment, and enrollment has changed. So if you're asking about changing it, yes, but reverting back and readjusting the numbers, that may not be in the best interest
of kids. So what you're pointing out is that there's a whole bunch of districts that have lost enrollment.
Correct.
And if we just simply go back to the formula, the broken formula that exists, there's going to be a bunch of districts going to get a lot less state aid.
Exactly. So be careful what we wish for. But if we do change that state aid formula, you know, I'm a superintendent in a rural school, and I would say, let's standardize the per pupil expenditure across the state. Mm-hmm. Let's find out what schools are actually getting it done with poverty, what schools are getting it done with students who are in the minority, and let's take a look at them, and if they can do it for $17,000 per student, then we should be able to do that across the state. And I know that we have differences in terms of our cost of living expenses, but certainly people from in and around Long Island are welcome to move upstate. We'd love to see you up here.
Sean, do you think that state aid is directed towards those districts that need it most?
I was going to answer the first question, and I'll put this in as well. I struggle with the conversation of funding as a sole solution to fixing the achievement and opportunity gaps that exist in schools. What I've experienced, I've worked in two suburban districts and in Rochester in an urban setting, and now I'm currently with the University of Rochester, who's a receiver for a failing school. In all four settings, there is a huge difference in the actual plan that aligns the system systemically. I think the first point over here was about bias. The one thing this election has revealed is that there is deep-seated bias in this country, and I am not as confident that as individuals we can fix that. I don't care if it's with more money, or if it's restructuring our schools. If the people sitting in the classrooms, individuals sitting on school boards, don't address equity and access through their policies, their practices, and their beliefs, then this conversation really is null and void.
So what I said before, it's not strictly an economic discussion.
Absolutely
this
not.
Is way beyond that.
Right. It's really forces, and I think that the commissioner is on her listening tour is trying to unearth this, is to figure out exactly what drives the moral fabric of our school systems. The first thing we did as a receivership school was to create, and first of all, to define that equity and access would drive every decision that we make. And then we developed a plan around that. What I've seen often in the districts that I've mentioned are decisions around programs that may or may not address the deep-seated issues within those school communities.
That's very interesting. So what you're saying is that through this EPO, this Educational Partnership Organization, whereby you're the receiver in a high school in Rochester, you have started with, we're going to have a school system here that's based on educational equity, and we're going to plan and fund it accordingly.
Right, and that's not just for students. So it's like equity defined as meaningful academic experiences for students, defined as quality working conditions for staff, defined as authentic engagement with the community. So our parents have not been authentically invited to the table. Our teachers have not been unlocked to do the things that they feel is right for students and for their own development. And our leaders are quickly becoming managers of systems instead of those who are thinking and doing within that system to improve them.
So you again, think this receivership program has an opportunity to succeed?
Absolutely. I think, and I thank the state. They have been fully supportive in letting us try some innovative things within that. And
we'll talk more about that later. Over here, yes.
There's one other thing that has changed the dynamic, and that's the tax levy cap. Everyone's favorite, right?
I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up, Carl.
As I see it, though, you know, what it has done to districts, both poor and rich, has caused them to use aid that was otherwise earmarked for other, perhaps better things, to backfill what was in the past, local share.
Right.
That needs to be paid attention to.
Well, and that really has really changed, I think, any districts that are here that were low-need, wealthy districts at one time could go out to their taxpayers and expect that they're going to raise taxes and we're going to make things work. That's no longer as easy a lift, maybe an impossible lift. And so they're far more interested in state aid. We've talked about the fact that the formula has just, the way we decide how we're going to fund our schools completely different. We used to think, here's the program we need. You'd go to the taxpayers, say, is this something you can support? Yes. Okay, we're going to build that program. Now it is, we're going to build our program over what we can afford. And that's the way the formula has changed completely.
It makes districts look backward instead of forward.
Let me go over here and see.
I just wanted to raise conversation around leveraging funding, and that I totally understand that there are concerns about the foundation aid and the amount of funding that districts receive to do the work that they need to do. But there's also an ability to leverage non-education dollars to also support the needs of students in schools, particularly when we're talking about students that have and come with a lot of needs to our school districts. I think that there is some education that needs to happen around other non-education dollars that can be used in the school system to support the needs of students. I mean, drawing down on Medicaid, using federal funds in terms of Title X and other funding streams, after school, summer school programming. There are ways in which we can bring in other dollars, leverage partnerships with nonprofit organizations, you know, like a Children's Aid Society, to support the school in ways that they can't do. And it's not expected for schools to do the kind of work that nonprofits do like us, or do what the hospital system does. But when you leave out your partners that can support you in different ways and help to remove the barriers to learning, you're missing out on an essential piece in terms of addressing academic achievement.
Well, you come from the Children's Aid Society in New York City, and you have a system of community schools, is that fair to say?
Yes.
And now we have community schools possible in other parts of the state. And do you believe this is a model that is going to work in other parts of the state?
Well, yes. And we talk about community schools not being a model, but a strategy, because I think people get caught up in, we have a funding stream that's tied to community schools, and that's all we need to think about. Mm-hmm. But if you think about community schools as a strategy to remove the barriers to learning, then the opportunities and also the plan that's put in place opens up tremendous opportunity. So we're talking about developing a plan with partners, external partners, like a
like
Children's
Aid. Like who? Who do you have in mind?
Oh, like a Children's Aid, local hospital. It could be with a government agency to bring in resources into the school building to coordinate them in a way that address the needs and remove the barriers to learning. And sometimes that is that schools feel like they need to do this work alone, but there is power in community, and you should never think that as a school system that you're doing this alone. Everyone should be engaged in the conversation around student achievement, from your mayor's office to your county executive, and even to your partners. And so if you're not having conversations across the city engaging all your partners, including your elected officials, in the conversation, then you're not really having a conversation about improving student achievement because you're missing the critical people that need to be at the table working with you on the plan and helping you to implement that plan.
Well, you have an organization set up to do that, but I'm not sure everybody else is there. So we have a lot to
but
learn
it can
from
happen.
You. Okay.
It can happen, yes.
Chancellor, you had to add something to that.
From personal experience,
yes.
We have been way back in 1993, 94, 95, we've been partners. So I had the first community school of middle school with a corridor, feeder, patterns, elementary, of about 2,100 students in one school that was open 6 days a week till 10 p.m., except Saturday was open till 6 p.m. Kids were doing project-based learning. Students were, we had a clinic, dental clinic, parent support services full-time, and all kinds of enrichment, technology, radio station, partnerships with Alvin Ailey. This was in Washington Heights, where we had second language issues, we had poverty, like many people have never even seen, a lot of homelessness, transitional types of situation. And the beauty of it was that it was seamless in terms of our work together as one community. The problem is that a lot of times people have difficulty because they've come through school and we have not, in the early stages of our school, we have had difficulty helping people to share their toys. And so they grow up and still the Lone Ranger, and I make the decision, not we make the decision.
Yeah.
And so these challenges in terms of what I call structural and social barriers in many situations get in the way.
And these people out here, school boards, could be those ones who could host that conversation with community partners. David, I want to get you in here on this conversation. Tell us what you think about this issue of sharing resources and involving the community, and maybe even sharing resources such as financial resources between wealthy districts and their poorer neighbors.
Sure. So welcome everyone to Buffalo, God's country, as I like to call it.
That's right.
And I'd like to hold up Buffalo as a shining example of what public, private, and community partners can look like. There is no debate the Buffalo public schools are on a roll. And I really credit our Board of Education for a willingness to hold hands and do it together. And I'll give examples of that. We have Dr. Nevergold here, and certainly my four colleagues in the second row here, Sharon, Hope, Dr. Harris-Tigg, and Paulette. So we have in Buffalo, in every single public school, a casework position that provides social services to our students. On a quarter, we serve 1,200 family members with food, clothing, shelter. We provide intensive casework that is funded by our county executive. We have a behavior health clinic in every single public school building, again, funded by our county executive. We have a two-hour extended day after-school program for free, built on some of the things we've heard about, art, music, science, enrichment programming, structured academics, funded by our public school district. And these are things they don't have to do. They're things that they are choosing to do.
We have easily accessible.
Easily accessible. We have summer camps available for kids in kindergarten through sixth grade. We have two mobile health units. We have mentoring for our students as they transition from high school to college. We have a scholarship promise to every graduate of our public and charter schools that if they complete their academic program, they can go on and have that huge financial barrier of the tuition component removed.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's funded by private sector. So I could go on and on. And I just think the one thing you need is a willingness to think beyond just my budget to our budgets, co-location of services, and a board that is willing to do the work. It's
That's what I love about Say Yes Buffalo and Say Yes, I think you have Say Yes Syracuse. I love that because you guys figure out, okay, we got issues. Let's figure out how we can do it. Let's not just wring our hands and worry about what we can't do. Let's figure out what we can do and make it happen. Derek, you had something to say? Barbara, I'm coming to you next.
Yeah.
Derek.
Yes, I don't really have numbers or anything. I'm not really familiar with the Foundation Aid formula.
That's a good thing.
But I do have, what I can run off of is common sense. United States has changed dramatically over the course of I've been alive, actually. And if you're running off a demographic of since 2000, it's 2016, a lot has changed. So, like, why not conform to the times? And if you are going to, go off of the 2000 United States Census, seems like it'd be unlikely to even have an accurate apportionment of aid anywhere.
Right. Well, we have problems. we know that. And you use common sense and foundation aid in the same formula, in the same sentence. That was an oxymoron. Barbara.
Well, thank you, Derek, because I'm going to agree with you. I don't want to lose the issue, and I'm not that well-versed in foundation aid, you know, understanding as well. But I think we don't want to lose sight of the fact that we are in a different world. In the decade since 2000 or so, Buffalo's poverty of rate for children living in poverty has risen from 37% to something like 58%. Unbelievable. So, you know, there is a tie-in with the funding and the needs of the children in order for us to provide the services, regardless, even the collaboration that we have with Say Yes, which is fantastic and is growing and developing and has occurred over the last 3-4 years or so that we've been able to pull together the collaborative pieces and the community schools that we're launching this year. There's still the issue of funding. And not that long ago, maybe about a week or so ago, there was a big rally in Albany having to do with C4E and the campaign for educational equity or financial equity. And Buffalo somehow is owed somewhere between $85 and $95 million. Well, we could do a lot with that. We could reduce class size. You know, we could do a lot of things, music, art, phys ed. So I don't want to lose sight of that because there are many mandates that are coming from the state as well that we are required to fulfill, and we're not necessarily funded to do that. So I think we still have to look at making sure we get the funding that we need.
Barbara, you brought up a statistic I think is worth repeating. The U.S. Census Bureau calculated that 58% of the children in Buffalo under the age of 5 live in poverty.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The only worse city is Detroit, my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
How does a public school system prepare when they see so many kids coming their way that are coming from the situation of disadvantage, poverty, things of that nature? How do you can anticipate it? How do you prepare for it? What are you going to do?
Well, I think first, you know, let's keep it simple. We sometimes make things too complicated, and it doesn't change across the state, poverty or not. We need to get the kids in school. That's number one.
Okay.
So we need to focus on that. Once we get them there, we have to have a good learning environment. And in some schools, there's a lot of time spent on just classroom management, which takes away from instruction. The third thing that we have to do is be sure that we have good instruction. And I know that we're all here and we have the breakout sessions and people can attend that. But, you know, good instruction is good instruction, and that's what's going to bring our kids along. The next thing that we have to do is we have to get the kids to do the work. And these are all things that need to be partnered with parents, communities, our politicians, and, of course, our school district leaders and teachers. And then the last thing, and I'm probably going to get booed on this, is we have to assess what they've done. We have to determine, are they moving forward? And poverty, although we want to say it's related, again, it's very simple. Come back to that expectation. Keep it simple. I mean, don't throw new things at us in education every time you look around. Look back to the 70s in MACOS. You know, man, a course of study was, you know, really not a success. And whole language, we all remember that years ago. And now we have the Common Core that's taken a ton of time away from actual instruction. So let's keep it simple. I think those 5 things will get us where we need to be.
Okay, I'm going to challenge that because I am going to say that a complex problem deserves not a simple solution. And so I'm going to say that we really have to look at this. I think part of the problem is that we've looked at these issues in a very simplistic way. We haven't looked at the root cause. We've got health issues. We have a state, by definition, is the most segregated state. We have issues of children that have double in terms of race and poverty, not just one issue. So while I do appreciate the fact that the state in its totality, it's very different And believe me, I think I can say it's very different from a rural to very different from a suburban to very different from an urban. And to really think about children that are living, for example, I can close my eyes and think of my children who live in shelters. That is a very, and move around. That is very different. That needs a different response. Because to think that if you have not ever, ever lived in the South Bronx, or worked with some of our children, as you have in Buffalo, that are coming out of some of these conditions, that before we can even get to teaching, we've got to get to health services. We've got to get them to a mental stability, a mindset that is ready. We've got to get some of the barriers, and that's why I talk about social barriers. We've got to address these issues. I think to think that they walk in through the door, they have a toothache, their mom and dad, we don't even, you know, they're wards of the Department of Social Services. We have got to dive in into some of these deep issues to then create opportunities and plans to respond to some of these very, very deep seated issues. And we've got to do that with resources. We can't just, you know, I'd love to standardize and say, if I give everybody $17,000, they will. It isn't so. It is a very complicated, and while I do appreciate the simplistic of trying to get to a deep-rooted, complex problem in a simplistic solution, I couldn't agree with doing that to a very complicated problem.